M. Stanton Evans is a stand-up comic who also moonlights as director of the National Journalism Center in Washington, D.C., and the president-elect of this society. Stan is also the author of a number of books on topical and various very serious subjects. One of my favorites, as a matter of fact, has been out of print for a long time, The Liberal Establishment, but I had an occasion to be reading it with one of my students not too long ago. And was reacquainted with the insights. Most recently, of course, the theme is freedom, has deservedly received a great deal of attention in many different forms across the country. And once again, to show how it's caught on, at least in some circles, it's been used as a discussion text in at least four different courses at Hillsdale College that I know of. Stan will speak with authority on the subject of divine law.
Thank you, John. This is a very tough spot in the lineup. It's been a marvelous day, and this great panel here and the ones that have preceded, and it's kind of hard to follow all that. And then I'm also quite conscious of the fact that I'm the last thing standing between you and the cocktail bar. I bring you greetings from our nation's capital and from our nationally recognized mayor, Marion Barry. To the relief of all, Mayor Barry has announced his availability for re-election in the next go-round and thereafter. And he also announced his slogan for the next campaign, which is, give me Librium or give me meth. Very inspiring. Joe Morris tells some lawyer jokes today at lunch. I think what really is appropriate is con law jokes. That's what we need. And just a couple of those. Professor Lawrence Tribe has published an article recently in the well-known journal Emanations from the Penumbra, in which he argues that because there were neither women nor minorities present at the Constitutional Convention, the Constitution is itself unconstitutional. Think I'm kidding, right? Also, an anecdote which was reported in the Boston Globe that apparently Professor Tribe and Professor Dershowitz were walking in Cambridge near Harvard Square, and they saw a crime victim, a mugging victim, lying in the gutter, bleeding, had been badly beaten, and Professor Tribe turned to Professor Dershowitz and said, "We must find the person who did this. He needs help." Well, so much for the con law jokes. The question I want to look at, picking up and connecting some threads that have been present throughout the day's discussion, to look at one thing in particular, a very important thing, and that is the idea of constitutionalism in our sense of strict limits on the reach of political power, which is what really we've been talking about in many different ways today, and the essence of our view, if I understand it correctly, is that constitutionalism is meant to establish a rule of law that is superior to all political power, and a rule that cannot be set aside at the discretion of that power. And the question I would like to address is, where does this idea come from? Perhaps even more important, or at least equally important, how does it gain practical political expression, and how specifically did it arrive in the United States? And it is my contention that a good deal of what people believe about this topic is not correct, and that is one of the things that is addressed in my book, and I won't go over all of that, but let me just pick up on a few things. It is certainly true that the idea of a rule of law, of justice, which is superior to political power, was mooted and affirmed by the Greeks and then again by the Romans, specifically by Cicero. The idea that there are norms of justice which are should be at least superior to the rule of force or of numbers. However, I would, without getting into the way the concepts are blended, I would argue, I think, with a good deal of support from the historical record, that the specific way in which this idea has come down to us and the practices that have come down to us are derived from our Christian heritage particularly, and that it is the Christian components of the higher law idea that have provided us, first of all, a conceptual anchorage for it, second, the specific content of our beliefs about this, and third, the political institutions that express it. And I think what is different, I'm not sure I'm expressing this very well, in our view of it from the ancient view, is that in our view, the idea of the higher law is an idea of something that can be set over against the supreme political power as a limiting principle, rather than being mediated through and thus compounded with that power, if I'm expressing that distinction clearly. And that is really, it seems to me, the essence of constitutionalism in our sense. And where we find this achieving its practical manifestation, as Forrest MacDonald has mentioned, and others, Professor Sandoz and others today, is in the medieval Christian era. And one of the things I think that is urgently needed by our society, by all of us here, and by the larger society outside, is to recover the history of that time and to recover the truth about that time, which has been obscured by what I call the liberal history lesson, the conventional history that is taught, has been taught for many decades in most of our academic institutions. I simply cite, and I brought here a couple of books I'm going to read from briefly because I don't want you to think, as Dave Barry says, that I'm making this up. But I would remind you, Magna Carta, Bracton, the king is under God and under the law. These are distinctively medieval notions and medieval institutions or practices. And I would suggest that Western constitutional history has been a series of footnotes to Bracton and Magna Carta. And there's much more there. I think the medieval period is really was the nursery of virtually all of our ideas of free government in a very modern sense, and also of freedom generically. Let me just read to you a passage. This is a book edited by Brian Tierney, who's a great medieval scholar, and this is the quotation that I will try to read rapidly. "Since then no one can make himself an emperor or king, the people raise some man above themselves for these reasons, to rule and govern them by virtue of his just authority, to apportion to each his own, to protect the good, to repress the wicked, and to deal out justice to all. If, however, he," the king or emperor, "breaks the compact by which he was elected, and ruins and confounds what he was established to order correctly, reason justly considers that he has absolved the people from their duty of submission to him, since he himself first broke the bond of mutual fidelity by which he was bound to them and they to him." In other words, social contract and the right of resistance. Now, we're taught that this was invented by Locke or Jefferson or some modern theoreticians. That quotation is from the year circa 1080, roughly contemporaneous with the Norman conquest of England, and it is a statement by a writer named Manigault of Lautenbach, who was a defender of the papacy in the argument over investiture of bishops at that era. Very clear medieval doctrine stated by Manigault, which has obviously entered into the general patrimony of the West. One other quote, and then I'll get off of this. This is from a book called Medieval Canon Law. If you're going to the beach next week, I would strongly recommend this. Very nice light reading. And this is These are passages. This is by a man named James Brundage, who is also a great authority on these matters. Listen to this, and compare this to what all of us have been taught. Many passages. Canonists, like other jurists of the jus commune tradition, were vocal champions of sturdy individualism and of an economy based on private ownership, which must, they thought, entitle a rightful owner to enjoy as much property as he could accumulate and to dispose of it in any way that he pleased, provided that its disposition threatened no harm to others. Going on. In property matters, medieval jurists were staunchly on the side of individual proprietors. Going further, expropriation by a ruler, they agreed, was tyranny, and subjects had every right to resist it. An owner might, of course, consent to be taxed if the tax was levied for an appropriate purpose. But free consent of the subject was essential to taxation as it was to matrimony. Coerced consent rendered the transaction void and illegal, and so forth. So there's a lot more, but I just want to, this is not me, that's them. Now, these ideas and many others were melded together in the medieval period into the British common law. And the fundamental thing that came out of that in the constitutional struggles of England was the affirmation and reaffirmation, tested many times, that indeed the king was under God and under the law and could not rule by his own discretion and caprice. And that was finally settled in the era of the Stuarts, first under Charles, with Charles I, and thereafter with his son, James II. Out of that emerged the notion in the British common law that while the king was limited, the parliament was not. And it became the constitutional doctrine of England and remains such to this day that while the king, and we know the attenuation of the royal power there, well, the king may not change the constitution, may not change the law at his discretion, parliament can. And that remains the ruling doctrine of the English system to this day. The common law, as we all know, was transmitted here, brought here by the settlers in New England and Virginia and elsewhere. But it was transmitted with a difference, and it's interesting to see how that difference worked itself out. It worked itself out to begin with, as we well know, in the struggle leading up to the War of Independence, in which the principal constitutional conflict, quite apart from other aspects of it, although this was underneath almost all of them, was over the question of parliamentary supremacy. And all of the leading proponents of the British interest said that Parliament was basically omnipotent. It could do whatever it wished. It could change the rules of the game, and there was no power beyond it. The Americans, those who became the advocates of independence and who resisted British power, all denied that. That was the one thing that identified the Whigs on the American side from the Tories. The Tories argued, yeah, we have to submit to Parliament, and the Whigs said, no way. Parliament is not omnipotent. Parliament cannot tax us without our consent, and that became the irreconcilable issue. I conjecture three obvious causes. One was the fact that the Americans were very distant from London and the developments over here lagged those over there. Second, connected to that, the Americans had always taxed themselves through their colonial legislatures, had never been taxed, had never been an internal tax from Parliament. And I would submit also that the religious axioms that they brought with them were operative here as well. And if you look at the literature of the time, you'll see these repeated over and over again, that there were axioms which transcended the pure flow of the common law and which posed stopping places against the glacial evolution of that as it occurred in England. And I quote one source, John Dickinson, and this was stated by nearly all of the people who addressed it, James Otis and John Adams and Jefferson and many others. Dickinson said this concerning American freedoms and this argument over tradition and common law. We claim them, our freedoms, from a higher source, from the King of Kings and Lord of all the earth. Say that over again. From the King of Kings and Lord of all the earth. Not exactly the French Revolution here. They are not annexed to us by parchment and seals, and many other quotations to that effect could be cited. Whatever the relative weight of these different considerations, they led the Americans to move a step beyond the step the English had taken. The English said there are limits on the power of the king, and the Americans said, no, there are limits on the legislature as well. And they stressed this in the Revolutionary period, and they thereafter stressed it in the Constitutional period. And one of the statements that struck me when I was reading this some years ago was that of Sam Adams in a circular letter that was communicated widely in 1768, fighting the Townshend Acts and so on. And he said this, in all free states, the Constitution is fixed. In all free states, the Constitution is fixed. That is, that you could not have freedom in a system in which a legislature could improvise new powers for itself. And that if Parliament could do this, then there was no Constitution and there was no freedom. And that obviously is another way of stating what I stated earlier. This is the idea that then becomes the bedrock of our constitutional theory. And there are two key components of this, which I think, the first of which is often stressed, the second of which isn't. And that is the written Constitution that we've talked about a good deal today. But the other was the idea of the Constitutional Convention. And these are correlative ideas that each requires the other, as Jefferson and George Mason and others viewed the matter. That is, the written Constitution was written down not by the ordinary legislature, because if the ordinary legislature wrote the Constitution, it could change it, and Jefferson was quite voluble on that problem. So the written Constitution had to be written by some other entity that represented the people in their constitutional capacity, not the ordinary legislature. That was the Constitutional Convention. And the Constitutional Convention not only represented the people, which is the idea that Gordon Wood stresses in his discussion, and it did that, but it also was a limiting concept because the Constitutional Convention was not a continuing body, so that after it wrote the Constitution, it dispersed. And all elements of the government were subordinate to what it had created. It wasn't around to change the Constitution, and no subordinate element of the government could change it either. And if you go to the wording of, say, Marbury versus Madison, or many other early statements of our constitutional doctrine, I'll read that too. I'm almost done here. This is what John Marshall, and I'm no great fan of John Marshall, but nonetheless, this is what he said. The powers of the legislature are defined and limited. Same idea as Sam Adams. And that those limits may not be mistaken or forgotten, the Constitution The Constitution is, for that purpose, its powers are limited. And to what purpose is that limitation committed to writing if these limits may at any time be passed over, brackets, by those intended to be restrained? The distinction between a government with limited and unlimited powers is abolished. It's exactly the same doctrine that the American founders prior to the Revolution stated in their battle with the English. I gave you a fake quote from Lawrence Tribe. I'll give you a real one. Compare it to the doctrine that I just stated. This is Lawrence Tribe stating the condition of constitutional law as he understands it. The Supreme Court has distinguished certain rights or liberties as fundamental. Other rights may be abridged by government as part of a rational scheme. Fundamental rights or liberties can be abridged only when demonstrably necessary to achieve a compelling objective. If the court decides to treat a right as fundamental, that right becomes very difficult to abridge. Gets better. On the other hand, if a right is not decreed fundamental, virtually any government action that abridges that right is upheld. Government is free to abridge a non-fundamental right for almost any reason. Unquote. Now, reading that, the first thing is when I read that, my reaction was very similar to my reaction when many years ago I read 1984. And I remember reading 1984 and sitting back and contemplating, and I said to myself, this is Orwellian. And not unlike when I read The Metamorphosis and The Trial, and I said, Kafkaesque, right? So, well, many things can be said about these words, the real words of Lawrence Tribe. One is, this is a recipe for totally arbitrary decision-making by the courts, full of weasel words, demonstrably necessary, compelling, rational basis, fundamental, etc. Those words can mean anything you want them to. But the thing that really struck me, other than those things, is that in this explanation, there is no mention whatsoever of either the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. They're not even referred to. It's just what our panelists, Leno and Roger and others, were discussing. Or it's just the court sitting there and deciding what it thinks is good policy at any given moment. Now, that apart, if you look at the sequence that I run through, and I'm almost done, it seems to me what you see, beginning with the biblical conceptions of a higher law, God's law above kings. Look at the medieval articulation and expression of that. The king is under God and under the law. Look at the British common law and the constitutional struggles there, which impose practical constraints upon the king. Look at the American extension of that, in which the same limits that were not imposed on Parliament in England are imposed on the legislature here. What you get is a series of ever-narrowing constraints upon the exercise of political power, culminating in our Constitution as it was. So, I would conclude that apprehension of divine law first provided the origin of our concept of constitutionalism and the practical creation of our free institutions. Principally through the medieval period, but then nourished the continued vitality of those ideas and institutions in America itself, thus confirming what we read in Scripture, that where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. Thank you.